down and buried. They lose their ball eyes and their lip mouths in the night. And stumbling through the street, they say, sir, do you got a light? And if you do, then you're my friend. And if you don't, then you're my foe. And if you are a deity of any sort, then please don't go. Namekitep, vamos ya.
That was the song Don't Leave Me from Regina Spektor. Hello and welcome to Talkin' Music. I'm Allie Lightfoot. KBNF DJ Ashley Crest and I attended the Rocky Mountain Folks Festival in Lyons last weekend, and we were lucky enough to sit down with musician Regina Spektor for an interview. This Russian-born American singer, songwriter, and pianist began classical training on the piano at the age of 6. After self-releasing her first 3 records and gaining popularity in New York City's East Village, Spektor began achieving greater mainstream recognition. The song Fidelity took her to the top of the charts in 2006. Spektor also sang the title songs for the television series Weeds and Orange is the New Black. Ashley and I spoke with Regina backstage after her performance.
Thank you so much. We're here at the Rocky Mountain Folks Festival in Lyons, Colorado, and you came a long way to be here, and we're glad you're here. Let's see. So my first question is, in Russia and the States, you know, the artists and musicians are treated differently, probably, I think. And what do you value from the influences and training that you've gotten from both places, both cultures, that you've been exposed to?
Well, it's a really interesting question. I don't really know exactly about modern Russia because I haven't I'm not in touch with that many artists there right now that are currently creating art there. But it's in my childhood, growing up, there was a tremendous amount of, in Soviet Russia, there was a tremendous amount of respect for the classical arts. And so you kind of grew up thinking that classical music was super cool and ballet was really cool and amazing and opera was really cool and amazing, all these things. And then when I showed up to America, at first I didn't speak any English, so I didn't understand anything. But eventually when I learned English, I was really surprised, because what I saw in, let's say, in sitcoms, you know, people would get punished with ballet tickets, you know, especially men. It would be like, you know, that would be like the big punishment, like, you know, and if you lose this bet, you have to go to the ballet or to the opera. And I was really kind of like, but that's awesome. Like, why wouldn't you want to go to the ballet or opera? And I sort of started to see where the place of that kind of art was sort of like the butt of jokes, or it was sort of like considered like for nerds and other things. And so that kind of was, you know, a big culture shock for me, because I think so much of culture is the narrative and how you frame things. And I've always felt so lucky that I had this classical training and this kind of beginning. I mean, I had a classical piano beginning in Russia, but then by the time I got to New York, I didn't really have any prospects to continue, because also in Russia we didn't have to pay for music education, and in the States you do have to pay for it. So it's not for everybody. So yeah, it's a very big difference. So I was sort of in that, you know, we're immigrants and we will never ever have enough money to pay for private lessons, kind of sort of going through all the stages of grief about it as a 9-year-old, as a 10-year-old, kind of being very, very sad about it. And then because of just the incredible generosity of human beings who can operate outside of systems, really, I met my family, met my piano, the woman who was going to become my piano teacher, and her husband. And because they were such amazing and kind human beings, she was from Peru originally, and he was a Holocaust survivor from Romania originally. And they're both classical musicians living just up the hill from us in the Bronx. So because they met my family and basically offered to teach me for free, me and my cousin, actually, for free. And I studied with them till I was 17. And that's really the reason why I'm sitting here talking to you right now. Wow. Yeah, so in some ways, that's been one of the things I've been trying to share with people, is that when people feel really hopeless within systems, they feel like, okay, maybe the politicians that are representing them are crooked and the laws are really horrible and education is not really fulfilling the things that kids need to learn. There are just choices that you can make as an individual. If you know something, you could teach, you could mentor. Mm-hmm. And what they did was really, you know, they didn't start a nonprofit. They just taught people for free, and then by doing that, by making that choice, by giving of their time freely, they have been able to help me create a life for myself and mm-hmm. and to be able to, you know, share yeah. music.
Yeah. My second question is about your songwriting. It seems very stream of consciousness and includes characters and stories and sound effects, and what's your songwriting process like?
Well, it's funny. You say stream of consciousness, but I sometimes think it's stream of subconsciousness. It's really like, you know, a lot of it is really, it's kind of strange to talk about, because it's from song to song it's different, uh-huh. and then from kind of headspace to headspace, it's different. And also a lot of it is pretty mysterious to me, which actually I'm very grateful for, because in a lot of ways, because I don't fully get it, it's very exciting and comforting to go into that world, because I sort of wander about. You know what I mean? Like, instead of just going into some reality that I've designed where I know every single thing and nothing surprises me, it's like going into a reality that I sort of know. I'm like, oh, that's a familiar house, but I can't remember anything inside it, so then I could just wonder. I don't know. It's kind of strange to talk about, but it feels like a mysterious in a good way, you know? To me.
It's almost like the story's being told to you in
a
way.
Yeah, and also it's kind of like, it's almost like you're a partner in something, and depending on what is going on, the same song can feel different. Or like, there are songs, for example, sometimes I just won't play for years because it just like starts to not feel good coming out of my mouth. Like, it doesn't just feel right. And I'm not like sad or frustrated that I wrote it, but it doesn't feel like I could sing it right now. And then weirdly, it'll like come back in 7 years and I'll just be like, oh, this song feels so right to sing again, you know, or some strange things like that. But
You self-released a few albums at the beginning of your career, and you were performing in the early days in the East Village of New York. And I think when you were playing around that area, it was maybe in the early 2000s.
Yeah.
So I was curious about some of the venues that you were playing in, and who were some of your earliest fans and the people who would show up for you and support you and encourage you.
I got really, really lucky. Because, so I went to university at SUNY Purchase, which was already like a crazy, fun art school, which was a supportive and amazing community of its own. So that was really where I first like found like a tribe of friends, and a lot of them are still my friends. One of them is my husband, so it's like, it's not, you know, it's just an incredible place. And a lot of people sort of had this interesting connection where they would go, a lot of graduates who were kind of older than me, I met them already when they would just come and visit Purchase, but they had left. And they were, a lot of them, playing at the Sidewalk Cafe, which still exists. And I just actually went to hear a really amazing show. It was a 20-year anniversary of my friend Jeffrey Lewis. Which, if you don't know Jeffrey Lewis's music, you are really missing out. It's some of my favorite songs. He's an amazing lyricist and really cool. Anyway, so he had this show, and it was kind of like it was an anniversary show for him, but all these people showed up that had played there when I was playing there. So it was really fun to just see everybody and to hear. And the reason why that community sort of existed and was very vibrant was because there was an open mic every Monday night, and you picked the number out of a hat, and my number was always like 7,000,000,002. So I always had to be like playing to like 1.5 people at 3 in the morning, and then I would take the subway back to the Bronx, which took forever and was like a surreal ride. But I really got to sort of, that was really the place where a lot of people started to kind of know my songs a little bit, and then I got my own like half an hour slot shows at Sidewalk, and then slowly I built those up to an hour, and then I decided that nobody wants to listen to an hour of piano music, and I made it back to 30 minutes, and for like a year I think I only was convinced that nobody could tolerate longer than 30 minutes of piano music. So I was just sort of learning there. And then the other place that I discovered at that time was the Old Living Room, which was on the corner of Stanton and Allen. Yeah, you know. And that was a great place. Like, the great thing about these places, they had no cover charge. So really, it was like, you know, they would pass, people would pass around, you know, a bucket or an empty mandolin or whatever and just tip you. And so anybody could come in very risk-free to check out new music, you know. And so it was this very, and that's how a lot of fans, and I had, you know, a marble notebook that I made everybody sign their email into, and I had this crazy mailing list. And then I would just kind of, some people would say, oh, you know, there's this bar and you could play. And so it would just start open. Eventually, I was doing like tours of New York City. I would just play maybe 20 shows in New York City alone just in like a month. So I would be going like to Brooklyn and one day, and then the next day I would be on the Lower East Side, and the next day I would be in Midtown somewhere because, you know, somebody who did an indie comedy night heard me and said I could do like two songs in between comedy sets, and, you know, and all like stand-up comedy sets, and all kinds of, I met all kinds of interesting people. I just sort of said yes to every possible show. I mean, I played in people's living rooms, I played in everywhere. And it was just really awesome to get that experience, to just I guess that's probably the best answer of how to people. Oh, and the only other thing I want to mention, since this is going to the human public, is I'm really, really, really grateful to a lot of the early people that were coming to shows, because one of the things that they did that I never thought to do, and I was terrible about this always, was they would record shows. So I have shows that exist from like 2002 and 2003 and 2004 that would never, ever have. And that's actually how I didn't do it so much this set at the festival, because I just felt like, you know, I don't know how much this, the festival audience appreciates deep cuts, but I just played, you know, some solo shows, just like these two solo shows in Brooklyn, and I'm gonna play, you know, in LA, and a lot of the time when I do like these solo shows that I've been kind of rediscovering for myself, I've been going on the internet, and because of these amazing people, I could figure out how the hell to play these old songs that I would never, ever remember. Like, I've been fine. Just today, I was practicing a song that I must have written when I was 18 or 19, and somebody has it recorded and up on YouTube. Like, and I don't know where or how, but I was able to relearn it, so I think I'm going to do it in L.A.
Your blood. Après moi le déluge, after me comes the flood. Be afraid of the lame, they'll inherit your legs. Be afraid of the old, they'll inherit your souls. Be afraid of the cold, they'll inherit your blood. Après moi le déluge, after me flood. Февраль достать чернила плакать. Писать о феврале на взрыв, пока грохочущая слякоть. Весною черною горит февраль достать.
That was the song Après Moi from Regina Spektor from her 2006 release Begin to Hope. And you're listening to Talkin' Music on KVNF. I'm Allie Lightfoot. KVNF's Ashley Crest and I interviewed Regina Spektor at Rocky Mountain Folks Festival in Lyons.
Your work always seems really playful and experimental and honest, and you talked a little bit about your creative process. I'm wondering if you've ever been in a creative rut, because I can't even picture it with you. I mean, you know, I don't know. It just doesn't seem like it's in your makeup to struggle in any way creatively.
Definitely. I don't think you're going to find any single person that does not. Because to me, like, creative rut is like, it doesn't ever have anything to do with you and your ability to make art. It only has something to do with, like, maybe circumstances that are happening and how your system, your unique human emotional and, you know, psychological system reacts to those circumstances. So sometimes it could be that you just have too many distractions, or you might just be too tired, or you might just be in the process of collecting and taking in the world rather than outputting. You know, it's like saying to yourself, what's wrong with me that I don't feel like talking to anybody at this party tonight? There's nothing wrong with you. You just don't feel like talking to anybody at this party tonight, you know? So it's like this a kind of, which, by the way, like, this comes after I think maybe as soon as I started writing songs, I would go through, which I didn't start writing songs early, like probably the earliest would be around 16, maybe 17. But I would just write a song. I'd be very excited that I wrote that song. And then I'd be like, as soon as I would like figure out how to play it, I would practice it and practice it and practice it. And it would be done. And then I would think, I'm never going to write another song again. Ever again. And that went on for like
this
years.
Fear that it would end. Yeah.
It's kind of like being really full after a meal and just being convinced that you're never going to be hungry again. Mm-hmm. And then you can have, like, you could be like a child and somebody will, your mom will say to you, no, like, trust me, in a few hours you will be hungry again. And you're just like, no, I don't believe you. I really feel very full. You know? It's kind of like that. But basically, if you make art, any kind of art, then that's just how your system works. So you're going to, at some point, output something. Mm-hmm. So then it just becomes like, well, how do you help yourself? Or some things might be better for you, some things worse. So you could take note of it. I mean, you could just be like, oh, when I stop drinking coffee, I'm way more sleepy and less excited and less, you know, and I have less concentration. So even though drinking coffee is not healthy for me, I'm still going to do it because it's good for my art or whatever it is. You know what I mean? Like, you make those decisions. But you could be like, oh, you know, everybody wants to hang out all the time and it's cool because we have conversations, but I don't make any art, so I'm going to, like, take a month off of hanging out with people, or I'm not going to go on the internet because all of my creative excitement goes towards outrage, and then in 20 minutes I just want to watch a movie, you know? That's spoken from experience, by the way. Yeah. So I'm like, so what's on? What's on Netflix? But, you know, but that's sort of my two cents on that, and I hope it's helpful to somebody.
This is how it works. It feels a little worse than when we drove our hearse right through that screaming crowd while laughing up a storm until we were just bone, until it got so warm that none of us could sleep, and all the styrofoam began to melt away. We tried to find some worms to aid in the decay, but none of them were home. Inside the catacomb, a million ancient bees began to sting our knees while we were on. A good refrain. You'll listen to it twice, 'cause the DJ is